My name is Judy Wallace, and it is my pleasure today to speak with Dr. Mary Howard about a topic on everyone's mind, response to intervention. Mary has just completed a book about RTI that is sure to become an essential text for schools and districts as they plan implementation. Her book, RTI from All Sides, is published by Heinemann. Now let me introduce Mary. She is often referred to as a teacher's teacher. For almost four decades as an educator with experience in special education, Title I, and reading recovery, equip her as she writes and travels discussing how to create high-quality literacy experiences for all children. Hello, Mary.
Hello, Judy. Thank you so much for coming today and allowing me to do this podcast.
Well, let's get started. I have some questions that I'd love to ask you, and we'll begin with one I think that is on everyone's mind. RTI is one of those terms that we hear everywhere today, but there seems to be still a bit of confusion about what it is, and would you just begin by explaining RTI for us?
That's an important question because I agree. I think there is a lot of confusion. The term RTI, also known as response to intervention, really highlights the intent of a rich process. And I specifically use the word process over program because that's the power of the RTI framework. The term illustrates a responsive attitude to instruction so that we can make adjustments as needed in any kind of instructional approach that we're using that is specific to children. RTI is about having professional responsibility, not just making blanket decisions or using scripted teaching that has become so popular in recent years, but we carefully craft instruction according to the needs of each child in any setting appropriate, in contrast to the approaches that we've used in the past. RTI doesn't view instructional support as something else we do, or a place that we send kids to be fixed. Any support that we use is coordinated with the general education program. In an RTI framework, we emphasize early intervention and acceleration using increasing levels of intensity. And these should always be good features of any effective support framework. RTI is a general education initiative, but it actually makes literacy a school-wide responsibility because now we're able to view students through a collaborative lens. We can offer a tiered system of support, and the tiered system of support allows us to have multiple tiers, and we usually talk about three tiers, so that we can adjust the intensity of our instruction according to the needs of students. But I think what's particularly important in this process is that we're making every single teacher accountable. For me, Judy, one of the most exciting things is that the general education teacher is the beginning. So we start with a good instructional program at Tier 1, and then we can offer the other supports of Tiers 2 and Tier 3. It's really important for me to emphasize that all of the tiers have to work in concert. So we can create a high-quality literacy program at Tier 1 and then offer high-quality safety nets at Tier 2 and Tier 3. And those Tier 2 and Tier 3 safety nets don't take the place of Tier 1. They support and extend Tier 1. With this kind of a framework, we can reposition responsibility where it's always belonged, on effective literacy instruction from the bottom up, and that means we start with Tier 1, and then offer supports that are extensions of those efforts. They're not separate things that we do. If we keep this framework in mind, Judy, we can all adopt a school-wide perspective that literally breaks down the walls that have previously existed between general education and the support programs that we offer children who struggle. If RTI is designed effectively, and we always have to keep our sights on that, if it's designed effectively, then the framework is responsive to the needs of every child.
Thank you, Mary. You mentioned that RTI is a process, really more than a program, and part of that process is the tiered process, as you mentioned. Could you tell us a bit more about the tiers and what educators really need to understand about those tiers as they relate to the children and our students?
Well, I think the first thing that they need to understand is the point that I made when we talked about that first question, and that is the relationship to Tier 1. From the very beginning, we have to ensure a high-quality literacy program from the ground up. In other words, there need to be invisible instructional threads of connected support that lead from Tier 1 to Tiers 2 and Tier 3. Tiers 2 and Tier 3 are secondary to Tier 1. We can't just relinquish the critical role of Tier 1, no matter what else we might do in the day. We cannot replace Tier 1 in any way. In fact, what happens at Tier 1 is going to largely determine how many students will need support at Tier 3. As you know, so often children need instructional supports simply because we're not giving them the kind of quality instruction with differentiation that we need to be giving them at the very solid base of what we do. In other words, if the quality of instruction is not of the highest level, if our teachers at Tier 1 can't differentiate, and if our Tier 1 teachers don't use varied assessments, not just the assessments that are proposed in RTI, but the assessments that are used on a daily basis, then nothing else we do is going to matter. And Tiers 2 and Tier 3 are not going to solve the problem. We have to have a high-quality instruction with every tick of the clock, irrespective of real estate, or no matter what door our students might enter. That has to be the basis. Now, with that said, statistically, about 20% of students, for a variety of reasons, aren't going to respond to that Tier 1 instruction, no matter how effective it may be. Now we have Tier 2 and Tier 3 that offer alternatives. These are our additional safety nets that will give students more than what Tier 1 alone can provide. It's not instead of what happens at Tier 1, but in addition to those things. If we don't keep that in mind, then we're not changing anything we do. We're just doing it someplace else. So we have to keep in mind the idea that Tiers 2 and Tier 3 are more than what we could provide at Tier 1. Those tiers have got to be inseparable in practice, not just theory, but in practice, and we can't lose sight of that. And yet many schools are beginning to, you know, lose sight of the fact that they have to be together. So Tiers 2 and Tier 3 let us increase the instructional intensity, and we can do that in three ways. First, we can decrease the group size. And as we move up the tiers, with each tier, we work with a smaller group of students. We can also increase the frequency and duration of instruction. So at Tier 2, we're going to meet with students more frequently than we would if they're in Tier 1 for those instructional supports, and even more frequently at Tier 3. Of course, it doesn't matter whether you decrease the size of the group and see kids more often if the quality of instruction isn't also adjusted. It really won't make any difference. We know that you can work with one student, and if you don't have high-quality instruction, it's not going to make a lot of difference. So we also have to increase the intensity of our instruction, and that means that we're emphasizing high-quality approaches like increasing the amount of modeling and coaching and prompting and feedback, and we're providing more reinforcement of the things that we're teaching students. It's interesting, though, Judy, that all of these things that I just mentioned, the modeling, the coaching, the prompting, the feedback, the intense instruction, these are not only effective approaches at Tier 2 and Tier 3, they're also effective approaches that the Tier 1 teacher should be using, and particularly with the children who happen to be going to Tier 2 or Tier 3. We can't just reserve our best instruction after students start to struggle. So so we can provide these instructional supports whether children are going to tier 2 and tier 3 or not. If every tier is based on these high quality practices, and if tier 1 is flexible enough to decrease the size of the group and increase the frequency and duration and intensity, even in tier 1, even if children aren't going to tier 2 and tier 3, then we'll have fewer students struggle in the first place. And that means we're going to have fewer students who are going to tier 2 and tier 3. In this way, every single teacher in our building will provide the best we have to offer. And then we can offer more as needed. And I think that idea of providing the very best instruction that we can offer is the key point if we really want RTI to be effective.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for that. And it really leads right into the next question I have for you. As you've talked, it seems as though the quality of Tier 1 is really the key, that if teachers do a really effective job at that initial tier, then we can really reach a tremendous number of students right there and not have to move into Tiers 2 and 3. Is that true?
Absolutely, Judy. There's no question about it. And I think this is where any discussion about RTI needs to begin, and initially where our effort should be. When I visit with schools, the first thing I say to them is that in that first year, I would put all of my attention on Tier 1, because if you don't do a good job right there, then nothing else is going to make a difference. You know, we talk about putting expert teachers at higher tiers and how important that is, but that's only a small part of the problem, because we have to consider that if children do go to those higher tiers, they're going to spend somewhere between 30 and 60 minutes a day, depending on the tier that they're moving into, in an intervention, but they're going to spend the bulk of the day with a classroom teacher. So every teacher must be an expert literacy teacher every minute. I think an important point that Richard Allington and also Farstrup have made, they've questioned that should we really be calling response to intervention, that whole term intervention, because that in a way suggests that we're only concerned with what happens when a child is in an intervention rather than emphasizing the quality of what we do all day long. I think that makes a lot of sense. They suggest that RTI really should have been called response to instruction, because I think it broadens our view of the quality of instruction, not only from an intervention perspective, but just good instruction. In fact, good instruction is an intervention when a knowledgeable teacher responds to the needs of students in the course of a day and makes any of those adjustments that I talked about, decreasing the size of the group, increasing the frequency and duration and intensity of instruction. So that means that expert teachers intervene from moment to moment as they are working to move students forward. And I think that if we can take a more global approach in that we're looking at high-quality instruction as a priority across the board, especially if we can resist the temptation of some districts turning RTI into response to assessment, as long as we don't lose sight of the primary goal of good instruction, and that begins with Tier 1. My point is that we can't look at an intervention as something else we do, because most effective instructional procedures are excellent interventions, and most good interventions are excellent instruction. For example, guided reading is an instructional strategy that teachers carry in their back pocket all day long, and it also makes an excellent intervention. Schools need to view RTI as a framework that we can reach diverse learners using every procedure we have at our disposal, and not a mandate that just requires schools to buy expensive commercial programs. RTI has to be nested in high-quality, comprehensive literacy practices in the hands of expert teachers, practices any teacher at any tier can use at any point. And that makes it imperative to invest money in professional development that promotes a responsive, differentiated perspective, not only for Tier 1 teachers, but for every teacher. Professional development helps teachers offer flexible, varied instruction at any tier, spontaneous or planned. And it's worth mentioning that much of our most powerful instruction occurs on the run or in the context of day-to-day interactions with students, particularly at Tier 1, but I think at any tier, a lot of our really good instruction is not necessarily even planned. It happens because we have expert teachers at the helm. I think it's also important to emphasize that we can increase the instructional intensity both in and across tiers. So placement in Tier 2 or Tier 3 doesn't change the Tier 1 teacher's responsibility and even opportunity to up the instructional ante of differentiation. They can accomplish this by forming smaller instructional groups that meet with greater frequency. And that means that if we have a child, let's say that a Tier 1 teacher has a student who hasn't been placed in Tier 2 or Tier 3, but the teacher sees that that child is having some struggles that may initiate some problems in the future, it's the Tier 1 teacher's responsibility to, as I said, up that instructional ante of differentiation at Tier 1, because that may alleviate the need to refer children. So in other words, as you said, that's absolutely the key. The Tier 1 teacher has to be the first line of defense, and Tier 1 has to be grounded in an atmosphere of responsiveness and differentiation. If that's not the case, then we're going to find far too many students who are being referred to Tiers 2 and Tier 3, and I think we're missing the point.
Well, Mary, you've talked a lot about the diversity within the classroom, and you've also used the term invisible threads. And I'm wondering if we could tie those two pieces together a little bit, and I wonder if you could talk about how a school could come together to ensure that there's coordination between and among the tiers so that we do support all of our students.
Well, and that's no small quest, Judy, and that's the piece that I think schools are going to really have to put some time and discussion into, and that means that they have to make it a priority to build time into the day for coordination. And this is the piece that I'm not seeing in many schools, that we're putting those tiers into place, but then we're saying, well, let's not give teachers any time to have the professional dialogue that's key to maintaining the inseparable nature. If we don't make room in the day for professional dialogue, then how are teachers going to emphasize a common goal or reinforce efforts in and across tiers? Collaboration is what will encourage that thread that is invisibly runs between the tiers. And it also allows us to have a common instructional language. And we can acknowledge what every single teacher brings to the literacy table. Coordination doesn't mean that we're saying every teacher needs to do the same thing. It means that we have that common language. We have that common focus for children who are struggling. This is going to take time. It's going to take time in the day and time to make this happen, but the alternative is separation of services. And then we're back to square one. RTI must be designed in a spirit of professional collaboration and coordination. And that means we bring teachers together to work hand in hand for the greater good. I think it's also important to emphasize that coordination is impossible if we're at cross purposes. In many schools, a different adult is working with a child at every single tier. And in many cases, they're using a different program. That is such a great idea if you want to confuse children in the process. So we have to be really careful. RTI is becoming a booming business with highly scripted programs, and they're being touted for Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3. We need more collaboration and coordination, not just in what we as teachers choose to do, but also what we as teachers choose to use. We don't need scripts that make teachers better disseminators. It's more important than ever that we are hypercritical consumers. I want to emphasize, though, with that point made, that programs are not the issue. In an RTI framework, I don't want it to sound like I'm saying that we don't want to have any programs in RTI, because there are some excellent intervention programs available. One that comes to my mind is reading recovery. As a trained reading recovery teacher, I can tell you personally that this is a powerful program, but there are also programs that are not very good, and some that really ought to be an embarrassment to every one of us for actually using them with students. And so when we're talking about coordination, it's important for us to also talk about the programs that we're using. So I want to emphasize 7 points that we need to keep in mind that will ensure that we're doing this within that concept of collaboration, coordination, and using effective program. One, we have to emphasize professional decision making. So many programs right now that are in place for RTI are very, very scripted. It's not that we don't want teachers to have a teacher's guide and to have something in front of them. This is a good framework for teachers to know what they need to use. But the problem is professional decision making in that loop? Because as any of us know who have ever taught for a day, you can't anticipate what the children in front of you are going to do. So you have to make adjustments based on professional responsibility. So number one, is professional decision-making in the loop? Number two, are there many quality text options? And I want to emphasize two things. Quality, not just boring and poorly written and contrived text, but quality text that children will want to read, and many text at a particular level that we can use with children. Number three, is the emphasis of that program on authentic reading over isolated skills? It's not that a program is not going to do skill instruction, but it's not going to make that the basis. The basis needs to be giving children an opportunity to apply what they're learning in authentic reading. Number four, is the emphasis on very small groups. If we have children who need an instructional support, then we can't do it in a group of, you know, 6 children or 8 children. Generally speaking, the most effective group size at tiers 2 and tier 3 is 3, and fewer for tier 3. For tier 2, it would be 3. Even though we propose 3 to 5, we're now saying that 3 is really the optimal number. And at tier 3, that might even be 1 student. Number 5, is it based on engaging interactions over passive learning? Many of the programs that schools are buying are just computerized assessment. They're just plugging children into a passive computer. It must be teachers and kids working together and a knowledgeable teacher working to support that. Number 6, an important point that I think we're missing is reading-writing connection. You know, what children write, they can read. What children read, they can write about. They can then read what they've written about that reading. So we want to keep that connection. And then I think an important one that we might ask, is the instruction going to be effective at any tier? Could we take that same instruction that we're using at Tier 2, that's proposed for Tier 2, and would it still be effective instruction if we did it at Tier 1 or Tier 3? Another example of an absolutely outstanding program would be Fountas and Pinnell's LLI. It offers the instructional sequence, but acknowledges the role of expert teachers. It matches the text with students. It builds skills, but emphasizes meaningful context in very small groups of 3. It actively engages teachers and students in the learning process. It highlights the reading-writing connection. It's appropriate at any tier if the teachers have the expertise and time to use it. I think it's worth mentioning, too, that both LLI and reading recovery were developed by experts in the field of literacy, and that's more than we can say about many of the programs that are in the hands of teachers and kids. For me, reading recovery and LLI make excellent templates for the kind of effective instruction that we need to make sure are in place, not only instructionally, but for interventions that we're using.
Well, Mary, you've talked about the need to break down the isolation that exists in schools, and I think that's such an important point, and it's never been more important than it is in RTI. You also have talked a little bit about the assessment, and you mentioned that we could almost call RTI a response to assessment sometimes. But assessment is important, isn't it? And so could you tell us how you might think differently about assessment as it relates to RTI and how that ongoing assessment will support the work we do within the framework in helping the child to grow into the kind of proficient reader that we hope he or she will grow into?
And isn't that the basis of everything that we do, Judy? I think that assessment piece is important. And I do think that we need to be careful not to allow it to become response to assessment because it requires a completely different way of thinking. But more than that, we need to consider if the assessment that we're emphasizing in RTI is adequate and appropriate, and we need to ensure that it doesn't exclude other assessments in the process. Assessment, for me, represents possibly the greatest danger zone of RTI in that the time and energy to collect numerical data can inadvertently lead to alleviating these other wonderful assessments that we do. I think worse, we may rely on data that's too short-sighted and narrow to make the kind of far-reaching decisions that we're making about children. We need to consider first, what should assessment accomplish? And there's only one answer to that, to improve the quality of our instruction. That's the basis of any good instruction. There are two primary assessment features in RTI. They're called universal screening and progress monitoring, and they're both legitimate. Universal, also called school-wide screening, poses the question, will students be successful with grade-level curriculum? We do this screening 3 times during the year, and it helps us identify initially students who may be at risk and then consider the most effective pathway. And as we do that second and third screening, we determine if what we're doing is really effective for those students. Progress monitoring is a little bit different. We do progress monitoring in the course of instruction. Literally, we monitor progress as we're doing instructional interventions so that we make sure that instruction is always responsive to the needs of our students. It's pretty hard to argue the value of that view, but now we have a conundrum. The sheer magnitude of those kinds of assessments, universal screening 3 times a year, and progress monitoring all the way through our instruction requires tools that are relatively fast, inexpensive, and easy to administer. The problem is that leads to a trade-off in quality. For example, many of the popular tools being used today focus on speed and virtually ignore other critical features of reading. So we have to ask if what we're assessing, what we need to know is what we're assessing, and if the information that we are gleaning from that is instructionally relevant. I mean, isn't that why we assess in the first place? Not to label kids, not to label schools, but to improve the quality of our teaching. If it's not, then we have a much bigger problem to deal with than what assessment to use. Clearly, ongoing assessment is necessary in RTI. But I think that what we need to also include in our discussion that we can't allow it to exclude informal day-to-day measurements embedded in the very instruction we want to improve. We can learn far more through an analysis of oral reading, kid watching, or interviews. And yet, I think that the most important informants of the reading process are often ignored. Qualitative features of reading, accuracy, strategy use, deeper levels of meaning. They're ignored because we're spending so much time. In some schools, teachers are being told to do progress monitoring every single day. So these kinds of assessments are far too important to be swept aside as irrelevant. And I think the best thing of all, those kind of assessments that I mentioned, those day-to-day, they require no expensive packages, nothing more than a book, a reader, maybe a recording form, and an observant, knowledgeable teacher. And these knowledgeable teachers have these effective assessments at their fingertips all day long, so that they aren't separate from teaching, but integral to teaching. Bottom line, Judy, is that RTI does require a new view of assessment, but not one that exacerbates the flawed view that we've had, one that puts us back in the right state of mind, an instructionally responsive state of mind. I don't think that RTI is going to be a step forward if we make the testing culture we've been drowning in even worse. But I see this happening in district after district. We need to understand that we need to use rich assessments and all of the kinds of assessments that are so critical to our teaching.
So while we need to pay attention, Mary, then, to efficiency, certainly quality is the most important thing that we need to consider in selecting those assessments.
Certainly.
The next question I have for you really has to do with the practicality of the implementation of RTI. And the teacher, in a sense, is that unit of change and that unit of that we need to pay attention to. So what advice would you have for a teacher as he or she begins to implement RTI? What are some moves that teacher should make or a school should make as they begin that process?
Well, definitely there are some things that we need to do, and I think it's important that we view it as, again, that perspective of the school-wide that we're working together, but it also is something that the teacher needs to do. And I think the first thing is that we have to adopt a we own this mindset. At this moment, we're very fortunate that there's no one RTI model. And that's one of my greatest fears for RTI, that there will come a point that someone comes along and says, this is the only way that we can do it. And I think that if we have a prescriptive model, if RTI turns into a recipe, we're going to undermine the benefits because each school has different resources, different students, different belief systems. And we can't be passive and simply sit back and let someone else give us a cookie cutter design. We know our students and our particular school culture. So we need to adhere to the framework because there is a very specific framework designed for RTI that's important. But we also need to modify it to fit the unique needs of our school. Do what you need to do to adapt RTI to your school, but take the time to do it right. Proceed slowly and with caution. Do your homework. Research the most effective design for you. Secure the most effective resources. RTI takes time, thought, and conscious effort to get it right. We cannot be complacent, but so many schools are saying, this sounds like a good idea. Let's go ahead and do it tomorrow morning. We can't do it sloppily and haphazardly. So let's start with the teacher. If you're a teacher, reflect. Be honest about what you do well and ask the hard questions. Are you reaching every child? Are you differentiating every day? If some children aren't making progress, are you reaching out to your colleagues? Are you working to become more knowledgeable on a daily basis? Is there a professional support system in your school? And if there isn't, why isn't there? And what else can you do to get that support in the meantime? We as teachers must continue learning every single day. 4 decades almost I've been a teacher, but I am still learning every single day. Now, if you're a principal, and that's an important piece of RTI, take a candid look at your role. How knowledgeable are you about literacy so that you can support your teachers? Because if you're not, you can't support them. Are you providing high-quality, differentiated resources or just purchasing what looks good on the surface and, by the way, rarely is? Do you spend time in your classrooms? Do you really know what's happening in your school? Are you giving your teachers time to collaborate in a positive atmosphere? What can you do to help teachers and yourself move closer to expert literacy teaching and learning? Are you learning right beside your teachers? You can't promote what you don't understand. Carve out time in your day to walk in their shoes because you can make better leadership decisions as a result. Do you insist that expert teachers provide instruction at higher tiers or assign the neediest kids to those with the least training? Are you working to make every teacher an expert teacher? As administrators, we need to ask these questions. As the instructional leader, if you don't know literacy at every level well, you owe it to the school and to your teachers to get a strong literacy coach or reading specialist who can support their needs and yours as you're working to become more knowledgeable. Make collaboration and communication the goal. Set up a professional problem-solving team. Have monthly RTI meetings. Insist on ongoing professional support. Every one of these questions are important questions we need to answer, Judy. Make no mistake about it. It's going to take effort and resources to make RTI work, and we can't cut corners. These efforts now are going to pay off in huge dividends for schools and for teachers and for kids in the end, and that ought to be our goal. We need to look at RTI and say, not what can we do to put it in place tomorrow morning, but what can we do to make it as effective as it can possibly be.
Mary, in your book, you have really talked about all the possibilities of RTI, and I know that you see it as having real potential for our students and helping them to become the most successful readers and writers that they can become. I wonder, as we conclude this conversation, I wonder if you have any reservations or concerns about RTI, in addition to all the wonderful possibilities that lie within it. Are there any areas that we might need to proceed with caution or avoid, in fact, as we approach the implementation of RTI in our schools?
Well, Judy, I do have some reservations. I do believe that RTI has such incredible potential, and I see it happening in schools. But my biggest concern are the rigid implementation and interpretation of RTI. And part of that is the excessive data collection with questionable purposes. The RTI framework is an excellent design in theory. Any design that makes every teacher responsible in a coordinated effort with ongoing assessment is a good idea. But my reservations don't come from the intent of RTI, but how it's being implemented in far too many cases. Really, I'm astounded by some of the absurdity that is taking place in the name of RTI, and I want to give you just a few examples. In one school, the classroom teacher is doing all three tiers. They're doing the Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3. Now, that's, you know, not a good idea if you want to make sure that you have quality instruction. And in many cases, these are classroom teachers who don't have the expertise and training. So essentially what we're doing is not only creating a situation that's absolutely impossible for teachers for the time, but we're taking away the quality, and we're saying, okay, here's a child who in some cases is not getting good instruction at tier 1, tier 2, or tier 3. Here's another example. In one school, the tier 1 teacher is not allowed, and I want to emphasize not allowed, if they have a child at tier 1 that they're concerned about, they are not allowed to go to the problem-solving team for 10 weeks. In other words, they're left to their own demise. They need to figure it out. 10 weeks, that's a lot of time not to have the support that teachers need. Another example, and these are not examples I'm making up. These are real examples. Another example is that in one school, once children are admitted into tier 2, now understand, they've already been in tier 1. We've already identified that these children are struggling. Now they're in tier 2. They are being told that they have to use grade level material at tier 2 for 2 weeks. Then they can go to the team and get permission, and that's the term that's used, permission to use reading level material after a period of 2 weeks. In other words, we've already determined that children need something more than what we can provide with grade level material. I think another example that concerns me deeply is that in some schools, they're buying a computerized program for tier 2 and tier 3 and simply plugging them into it. In so many cases, RTI is being mandated and controlled by an agency or a university, and teachers and schools are powerless to do their job without permission and often without any meaningful support. And I think that's an important point, having a reading specialist or a coach to support them. These kinds of things are nonsense, and they're hurting kids and teachers alike. We've been in massive denial in this country. We can't just perpetuate a one-size-fits-all, test-more mentality. The answer isn't to buy more scripts and dictate teaching. We can't just add more stuff that removes our kids even further from what we want to accomplish, proficient, skilled reading and writing. We can't continue to put books in hands of kids they can't read and then blame kids for our inadequacies. I think we also can't put teachers in an impossible situation and then blame them for what we choose not to do. We need to insist on high-quality instructional practices that emphasize authentic context and then place knowledgeable teachers at the helm. If we aren't diligent, RTI is merely going to give lip service to change, but we'll continue business as usual, business that hasn't been working. I think that in order to understand how to ensure that this doesn't happen, there are 7 factors that must be the driving force of RTI. The first is what we've been talking about from the onset, high-quality instruction beginning at Tier 1, and that invisible thread of high-quality instruction that goes into every single tier. We also, number 2, need to make sure that we're using responsive teaching with differentiation, and that means that we are individualizing our support with material. We can no longer afford to simply put grade-level material in the hands of Tier 1 teachers and think we're doing the right thing and think that we're going to do that one-size-fits-all. Number 3, we need to start with early intervention, and I'm not just talking about intervening at grade 1, but from the very get-go, the very beginning of the year, using ongoing assessments, including kid watching, so that we have a sense of awareness throughout our time and that we're using other eyes and ears. We have that problem-solving team. or other teachers or the reading specialists, so that we have another set of eyes and ears to be diligent and give teachers support and give kids support when they need it. The fourth one is that we need coordination of support services that we've talked about. They need to be inseparably connected. Number five, there's got to be professional collaboration and dialogue. This is a point that we absolutely cannot let slip through the cracks. And that means that we need staff development. We need to focus on practices over packages. It's not about buying a package and then telling teachers how to use it. It's about how to help teachers use good instructional practices on the run, every day, in the context of day-to-day interactions with kids. And then there's another one that we need to emphasize, and I talked about in that last question, and that is to have a knowledgeable administrator who understands literacy at deep levels, is learning alongside teachers, and is providing the support. And many of those things that I just highlighted, Judy, were in the February-March edition of the IRA Reading Today. We need to be grateful that the IRA is involved in our discussions about RTI, because I think they're going to help us have a more thoughtful discussion that we desperately need right now as we go from RTI on paper to RTI in real schools and real classrooms. As long as we maintain our sights on these critical factors, as long as we stop some of the foolishness that's taking place in the name of RTI, then RTI will meet the promise. And any reservations I may have are going to prove unwarranted.
Well, Mary, thank you so much. You've given us a great deal to think about and also clarified some things about RTI for us. We'll wait impatiently for your book to come out, RTI from All Sides, and we'll know that there'll be more answers to questions. And I thank you again for your insights and your commitment to children and teachers and high quality, thoughtful, responsive literacy programs that keep all of our students, our ELL students, our special education students, and our students who just struggle a bit with literacy. So thank you so much for your thoughtful approach to RTI.
Thank you, Judy.